Hello and welcome back to our usual monthly interview with one of your local MPs. Today, we're talking to Bambos Charalambos. Now, we do have to start the show on a somber note because last month we made the call not to record any of our political interviews after the tragedy at Westminster, what happened to Sir David Amess. Of course, we here at Radio Verulam extend our greatest sympathy to Sir David Amess's family. And, you know, to you as MPs as well, it must have been very tough, Bambos, kind of reminding you of the dangers that are part of this job. Has it been a tough period for all in Parliament with this terrible event hanging over everyone?
Yeah, I think it was quite a somber affair when we had to come back and, remember Sir David. I mean, his office is directly beneath mine in the same building in Westminster, so I'd see him all the time waiting for lifts, and he also would chair some Westminster Hall debates I was responding to or some committees I was on. So, you know, I knew him reasonably well. He's always, you know, had a smile on his face. He was always, you know, able to chat with him, and he's a very decent guy, and he'll be a huge loss. And a lot of us did think that, you know, there but for the grace of God go I, because it could have happened to any one of us. And it does make you stop and think about what other measures you would need to introduce to make yourself feel safe in your surgeries. So my team and I are looking at that. I mean, I still want to be able to physically meet people and engage with people. And it's very much a community that I live amongst and some support. But equally, I'm very conscious that we need to make sure that we're safe and my staff are safe.
Yes, and kind of adding to this, you know, you've talked about on like a micro level for your own personal safety there. But going forward, do you believe that there needs to be something done to stop this occurring on a national level? You know, the discussion points after Joe Cox was what can be done to protect MPs. Some politicians have expressed their sadness that nothing has been done. What do you believe needs to be done to get that balance right? Because I think the British parliamentary system is unique in its way that, you know, constituents can meet politicians, talk to them in person, and they have a personal relationship with a lot of people. How can we strike the balance of offering protection whilst making sure people are safe?
It's a tough call because you don't want to be in a situation where MPs are distant from their constituents. So it's trying to find that balance. It might be just doing more security checks on constituents who you'd see appointments only at your surgery. It might be that we need to look at whether we need security at the surgery or not. Because, you know, the surgery is the one place where as an MP, people know exactly where you're going to be and at what time, and they can make plans to attack you there. Other places, it's far less likely because you will have they may not know where you're going to be and at what time, unless you've advertised it. So there are steps we can take to tackle that. So I guess what I'm saying is, you've got to strike a balance, and that's what it's got to boil down to. And you know, whether it's more security at surgeries, whether it's having emergency alarms that you can activate that would alert the police if you're in danger, whether it's doing more background checks on the people that you're going to see, all these things will help. But it may be a combination of things. So I'm still looking at which things would work best for me.
So is that kind of on an individual level now, or is there kind of a cross-party consensus that something needs to be done? Is Labour making plans as a party as a whole to kind of combat this problem?
It's not a party issue. It's more of a collective house issue. So I think it's the Speaker and the Speaker's office have given us some really good advice, and Parliament has a parliamentary police liaison team that we can also call on to make sure that things get their advice about how things can be made safer. And we've done that, and we're looking at making the office safer. So I think it's a combination of things, but it's not a party political thing at all. I think, you know, we saw that, you know, it's not just David Amos was Conservative, Joe Cox was Labour. There was a Lib Dem MP whose staff member got attacked about 10, 15 years ago. So it doesn't, it's not a party political thing at all. And I think we'd all be on the same page on this.
So just one final question on this, Bambos. Have you ever felt unsafe then when you've been at a meeting or any such event?
Probably not a meeting, but there was one occasion when somebody was came into the office and was very abusive and was shouting in my face and seemed out of control. But that was the only occasion where I felt particularly unsafe.
Goodness me. Well, I hope that doesn't happen again, and I hope to hear from you soon. Obviously, we talked to Daisy Cooper and Bim Afolami as well on something across the parties that can unite and make the experience safer for all of you. But since we last spoke, you have spent a lot of your time scrutinising the National and Borders Bill. You have dubbed it the Anti-Refugee Bill, though. You explained that the proposed Nationality and Borders Bill will not only break international law, but it actually doesn't work. What was wrong with the bill, and what would Labour do differently?
Well, where can I begin? So a number of things the bill does, and I'll explain why they don't work. So one of the first things is it treats, it penalises people who come to the UK, who are seeking protection from the UK in accordance with international law, on based on how they arrive. So, and you get less protection if you've come here by an irregular route. Now, clearly, that's a breach of the Refugee Convention of 1951, which the UK is signatory to, because you're not allowed to penalise people on how they've arrived. So that's one problem with the bill, it's a breach of international law. The bill also includes measures around offshoring. This is whereby you send people to another country to be processed. There was a story in the Times that suggested Albania was a possible country that would do this. The Albanian government have utterly refuted this and have condemned the UK government for spreading fake news about this. So the UK doesn't have a place for offshore processing. But also in the article, it said it would cost £100,000 per person who would be processed there. This is an astronomical amount of money, which could be better spent actually fixing the system that we already have, making sure that works properly, because at the moment it's not. The bill also includes areas around modern-day slavery, which are treating people who've been trafficked as if they are criminals themselves. But also treating children the same way as they treat adults. This is bizarre, totally unheard of. So those are just some things that are wrong with the bill. I mean, if you think about sort of, one of the main problems with the bill is that the premise is that the asylum system is broken, but the government have had 11 years to fix the asylum system. And they've just made it worse. I've had constituents that have taken, it's taken them 7 years to have, or longer, to get their asylum claim processed. Nothing should take that long, you know, and it does seem to be a massive failing on the government to not be able to fix the system. So what would Labour do? Well, I think, first of all, we need to introduce routes for safe passage, so where people can apply to enter the country lawfully if they've got a proper genuine asylum claim. At the moment, no such routes exist. And also the to have a situation whereby the processing of asylum claims is dealt with more swiftly, but not just asylum claims, but people who are removed swiftly as well, because that's also another part of the problem, that people are spending far longer here than they should do. And I think that's going to be, I think those would be the sort of measures we'd want to introduce. So making the system work far better than it does, and introducing safer routes, which are legal routes that people can embark on to apply to come to the UK if they're seeking protection. Those are two of the main things we will do.
Would you also say that Labour would introduce a different mindset towards those, you know, applying? Because at the moment, the presumption seems to be now in the bill, I might be wrong, so correct me if I am, but it's assumed that most people are economic migrants trying to exploit the system. And it's kind of forgetting the mantra that's, you know, part and parcel of the British legal system of innocent until proven guilty. Is that something that Labour would do as well?
100%, because most people, the focus has been on small boats. If you think about it, economic migrants, one thing they want to do is to be able to work. So of the people that cross the channel in small boats or come to the UK via other irregular routes, the vast majority, over 98%, seek asylum. If you seek asylum, you're not allowed to work, and you have to live on £5 a day via, you get something called an Aspen card, which is a card you can only acquire certain products with to survive on. And that's it. There are people who I've met who are asylum seekers who are highly educated, who would be a huge benefit to the country if they're able to work, who are living on £5 a day, who are desperate to pay their way to contribute to their stay while their claims being processed, but they're not able to because it's taken so long for their claim to be processed, and they're frustrated by that.
So adding to this discussion point then, I think what is quite interesting for our listeners as well is maybe the due process that happens in Parliament. So can you explain how you go through the bill, how you scrutinise it, the interesting foible of maybe if you don't stand up at the right time, then you're moved over. But also, how often can you actually make changes?
So a bill has a number of stages if it starts off in the Commons. So first reading is when it's just read out in the chamber, just the title is read out. Second reading is when you have a debate about the principle of the bill. And then it goes to committee. And in the committee, you take evidence from witnesses, and we had the evidence sessions in September. And most of October and the early part of November, you then in committee go through the bill line by line, clause by clause. And that's where amendments are tabled and where you have debates about each individual clause. So in the 3 or so weeks that the bill was debated in committee, I must have made about 50 speeches on the bill, which are very focused on particular clauses that we make. The committee is made up of 10 Conservatives and 7 opposition MPs. And we then have a vote on each clause, each amendment that's been proposed, each new clause. And then it goes to the report stage, where there further amendments can be tabled. This is on the floor of the House. And you then have third reading. And then after third reading, it goes to the Lords. And the Lords can table their own amendments. Then they come back to the Commons to be approved or not approved, as the case may be. So those are the stages. So the bill still has a fair few areas to visit first. So I think that will be what's going to happen. So we'll wait and see with interest what happens next.
But you've explained there's a numerical advantage to the incumbent government. How can you overcome if there's a disagreement? You know, say if all 7 of the opposition party are united against a certain clause, but obviously the incumbent government are proposing this bill and so they want that to go through. Is there any way that you can actually change this legislation?
It's highly unlikely, but there are other Conservative MPs who are very concerned about this bill and about what measures it's introducing. So I think at report stage, there'll be a number of Conservative MPs who will have tabled amendments, and we will look at each of the amendments and see whether we want to support it. And obviously, because it's supported by a backbench Conservative MP, I imagine they would have their own supporters, and there's more chance of that bill becoming law with the supporters voting for the amendments than there would if if it was a Labour amendment that was being tabled. So we need to see which Conservative amendments have been tabled from the backbenchers.
An interesting insight into what goes on behind the scenes and shapes, you know, the listeners' legislation. One of the biggest talking points, though, over the last month has been the second jobs scandal and the debate over whether MPs should have second jobs at all. First and foremost, though, Bambos, I do have to ask, have you ever been paid for a second job whilst being an MP?
No, I don't know how anybody would have the time to do a second job as an MP, because it's, for me, it's definitely a full-time job. I would never do a second job as an MP.
And so adding to that then, I guess you've kind of answered my next question, but I have to ask it, because do you believe that it's right that MPs should be allowed second jobs, especially with the fact that earnings are about three times above the average pay of a UK worker?
No, I don't think MPs should have second jobs. Maybe if they work for the public benefit, if they work in the NHS, for instance, perhaps, and they need to practice to keep their registration, then perhaps that might be something that could be allowed. But on the whole, no, they shouldn't. They shouldn't have second jobs. I think we are very well paid for what we do. It's a huge privilege to be a Member of Parliament, and I think that should be the end of the matter.
I mean, is there a further argument that actually being a Member of Parliament, say in that situation there where you might have to train or keep a certain amount of work to be in a certain body or a work area of the economy, doesn't being an MP though make and enhance your CV so that if you were unfortunately unelected at a next election, that you actually find an acquisition of a job almost easier?
That may be true of some jobs, but not others. So some other jobs you may need to have continued to practice over a period of time to still be able to do that job. So say you were a doctor, you may have to practice for a certain number of hours to make sure that your doctor's certificate is still intact. So I think in those instances, perhaps, you wouldn't want to lose somebody who is trained really hard and has benefited. You may not want to lose them if they were to stop being an MP. They may have something good to offer still. And if that requires them to do some work to keep their certificate intact, then I think there is merit in that, and that should be allowed.
So going forward, if the government, the current Conservative incumbents, do not pass legislation to change that situation, is that going to be something that Labour go after in the next general election? Is that going to be part of your manifesto? Is that maybe a pledge?
I think so, yeah. Certainly was a pledge at the last election, so I see no reason to change that.
Adding to the discussions around this then, previously when I've interviewed you, you've been reticent to call the incumbent government corrupt. You kind of explained what you would say are the specific terms almost to use that word. However, now you are quite happy to lay that charge, especially in terms of this discussion point that we have here about second jobs, but you've kind of included other things as well. What has changed to make you think that they qualified to be dubbed corrupt?
Well, I think what we've seen is that the revelations about the allocation of contracts, which various contracts under coronavirus seem to have been handed out to people that have that had contact with senior Tory MPs. Certainly Lord Bethel and his WhatsApp messaging seems to have been shocking about how he's deleted all his WhatsApp messages that related to contracts. Is really worrying and should not be allowed. So I think that was one thing. Also, the revelation that former Tory treasurers received, who donated £3 million or more to the Tory party, were able to gain peerages is also, I mean, that's as blatant a level of corruption as you could hope to have. And then the Owen Paterson stuff is also something that is truly shocking and shows a level of corruption when somebody's taking money to ask questions for the benefit of the two organisations he's being paid to ask the questions for. So for me, that's those are examples of where I would call that corruption.
Okay. And so I want to move actually on to a discussion point about the Labour Party, specifically your leader, Keir Starmer. And, you know, in the previous question, I asked you about maybe pledging to remove second jobs if that was a Labour Party kind of idea. As you said, it's an idea that you have kind of stuck to before. In the 2019 election, you stood on a manifesto, and Sir Keir Starmer did as well, on a pledge that the House of Lords needs to be scrapped. Then since Keir Starmer has obviously become the leader of the party after Jeremy Corbyn has been removed. But when he was questioned on the Andrew Marr show, Sir Keir Starmer, he seemed to almost change the tone of total abolition to the House of Lords into what he dubbed as a change in the House of Lords and a commission to review it. Why has he seemingly made a U-turn?
Well, I don't know if it's a U-turn as such, but I think there is, Gordon Brown is leading a commission, a constitutional commission, into not only the House of Lords, but other constitutional issues. And I think rather than trying to preempt what the commission is going to come out and say, I think it's just saying, let's wait and see what they say. I mean, my preference is to have to make the House of Lords more democratic. So if not 100%, at least 80% should be elected, in my view, with maybe some places reserved for experts in particular areas so they can do the scrutiny that the Lords deserves. But there must be some form of accountability, and I think an election would be the best way to achieve that. So that would be a sort of thing that would be closer to my thinking, I think.
The word pledge is a very strong one. You know, it's almost, not quite, but almost legally binding. Why would he pledge to a overhaul, a scrapping of the House of Lords, and then change tone? Surely that must be counted as some sort of U-turn. Otherwise, he would just keep on with the scrapping of the House of Lords. Is this something that maybe you disagree with your party leader on?
No, I think I think we just want to wait and see. I mean, the scrapping the House of Lords may still be what the Commission comes up with. So I think we just need to wait and see. I don't think it's hedging bets or anything like that. I think it's just having given somebody as eminent as Gordon Brown the task of doing a commission, I think it's disrespectful to preempt that. So I think it's more a question of let's wait and see rather than changing a viewpoint.
And so what would your ideal be of the House of Lords then? Would it be a House of Lords, as you said there, you know, maybe 80% kind of elected, but then would it also be given more powers to kind of almost offset the power of the House of Commons?
Well, again, I think the it's not necessarily a problem from the House of Lords because there isn't an overall majority built in. So you do get lots of amendments coming from the House of Lords already. My preference would be to see 100% elected second chamber, but with you know, with PR maybe as the system for electing them. And I think the second chamber should be able to do proper scrutiny. So you may need to have people with a certain level of expertise to do that scrutiny. So I think that's what my preference would be. And yeah, hopefully that will be what the commission comes back with.
So this is the last of my questions. Obviously, some of it is shaped by community questions. We get questions sent in about these kind of meta discussions of politics in Britain over the last few months. But this is the final one before we go on to what listeners have sent in. And you can always email me, jason.mckenna@radioverulam.com. You can, you know, use our DMs. You can comment below the video, the broadcast when it goes out as well. But the final one is, it's 103 years since Parliament allowed women to stand as MPs. But since then, of the 5,000 MPs that have been elected to the House of Commons, only 556 have been women, about 10%. And even now, Parliament is less than 40% women. Bambos, is there, you know, this is probably a very protracted conversation, maybe for another day, but do you have maybe one idea that needs to be brought in for greater gender equality in our political system?
Well, certainly the Labour Party has 50% of its MPs who are women. So I think it's the other parties that need to catch up. So I don't know what the solution is for them. I know that what's worked with the Labour Party is having all women shortlists, but also having a mechanism whereby you're able to train women by the Jo Cox Foundation or the female leadership programs. I think all those things certainly help to, and just asking women to stand for election, I think that's quite powerful as well. So so my suggestion would be just to get out there and to try and encourage more women to stand and to give them the support they need and the confidence they need to stand in the first place, but also having all women shortlists to make sure that you do have parity in Parliament. I think Parliament would be far better if we did have more women in it as well.
Let's move on to those community questions then. And lots of people have emailed in with concerns about the Enfield Town train station crash. The driver has now been arrested. There is obviously an ongoing investigation, so we wouldn't like to comment on that and cause any disturbances there. But many have asked, what assurances or what work will be done to see that something like this doesn't happen again, Bambos?
Well, obviously it's quite a shocking thing to happen. I think that there will be an investigation and the results of that investigation will be published. So hopefully there'll be lessons to be learned from that. I'd be inclined to wait and see, but I want to make sure that that all my constituents feel safe traveling on public transport. So I do think that the first thing is to make sure that mistakes aren't being made that can be avoided. But secondly, like the safety of passengers on buses and trains and on the tube are paramount. So I think that would be a criteria for me to make sure that people are reassured and don't feel that they, you know, they may be having an accident anytime soon. There have been dozens of train journeys since the accident happened, all without incident. So I think that this was more or less a one-off. And from the suggestion, it could be that it was human error, but we don't know.
Yes, and I guess that is the whole point with the investigation. Most people are concerned at the time. And unfortunately, it does take a while for, you know, the truth to come out with these situations. But a lot of people have asked as well, will you commit to making sure that whatever the investigation reveals, that cause does not happen again? Will you kind of make it a personal duty to oversee that it is as safe as possible on Enfield Transport?
100%, absolutely. So I will see what the report says and make sure that those recommendations are put in place by TfL, by the Mayor of London. So I will put pressure on them to be implemented if TfL or the Mayor don't necessarily, I can't think why they wouldn't, don't agree with the recommendations, but I'm sure they will.
Andreas has said, I saw your trip to refill at the Grange Zero Waste Shop. How often do you do zero waste shopping, Bambos?
Not often enough, and I need to get to the refill at the Grange more often. So I'm sure that Andreas will be seeing me in there from time to time over the coming weeks ahead. But we do need more of these refill shops. So I think they're a wonderful way to reduce waste. So if you see me around the Grange Park area, you'll know why.
And I guess, you know, Andreas hasn't asked this, but I'm curious, what kind of things do you like to buy at the Zero Waste shop?
Well, certainly things like, you know, like the breakfast cereal. So things like muesli, like sort of cornflakes and like those sorts of things. But obviously they've got lots of pasta. They've got they've got beans, they've got grains, they've got all sorts of things. So those are all sort of things I would normally, you know, buy in a supermarket and with packaging. So those are some things I would get. They've got some lovely soaps that smell absolutely amazing. So I recommend the soaps there as well.
And I would recommend it as well. You know, I've walked past there. I've been there many times. There's the pharmacy next door that I go to. And it's kind of very alluring, the smell, and it kind of gets your mouth watering. And also you're kind of like, oh, I want to use that. So I do recommend that shop too. Amy has moved it on to, though, one of another big topic that has kind of been dominating it. And this one, you know, will obviously shape our futures. It was the outcome of COP26. Bambos, Labour had differing demands to the government at COP26. With the talks now over, Amy asks, where do you differ on the outcomes? And do you believe it was success or was it lip service as the 1.5 Celsius will not be met?
I was trying to unpick that. I mean, my fear is that we will hit 1.5% and will, you know, and that will lead to more extreme weather conditions, more droughts, more flooding. So I don't think enough has been done. I don't think we are going to avoid hitting the 1.5%. And that's really bad news because there are other issues linked to that as well, things like the extermination of species and so on and so on. So having said that, there were some good positives that were agreed at COP26. Obviously, they're not binding, but the big issue was around coal and to allow certain big nations to still carry on producing fossil fuel and warming up the environment through CO2 emissions is deeply worrying. So I'm very mindful that none of these COP26 goals were or are binding, then it's a real worry that, you know, the people seem to try and get away with it, and that will damage the planet. So we still need to keep the pressure on the governments that didn't sign up. You'll have heard like the comments from some of the smaller islands. The delegate from the Marshall Islands particularly made an impact on me because they're saying, well, we may not be here because you've just voted to wipe us out, because with rising sea levels, they will struggle to survive. And that's really, really sad. And I think we all need to hang our heads in shame because much more needs to be done to challenge the global warming. And it doesn't seem to, you know, we still have a long way to go.
I think that's an interesting comment that you actually say there, that we all need to hang our heads in shame because, you know, coming out of that conference, a lot of blame seemed to be on China, India. But I think Amy's question is kind of hinting at this. There seems to almost be a little bit of lip service from European countries because recently the EU did a deal with Brazil over meat imports, and there's lots of trading between these markets in place. Do you think that there needs to be a more serious commitment instead of kind of, you know, grandiose words saying we are committed to this? I mean, looking at, for example, the planting of the trees, where are those trees going? It all seems to be high ideas, but with no kind of real solidity to them.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I think planting of trees is one way, but it's being used to offset the CO2 emissions. So net zero doesn't mean you don't produce any CO2 emissions. It means you have things to offset those emissions. So I think actually looking at reducing the CO2 emissions in the first place would be a good way to go. But clearly things like diet, I think we will need to eat less meat because it's not sustainable to have so much meat production worldwide. It would just, you know, you need to have lots of land for grazing. That means that forests have to be cut away to provide that land. And it's just not a sustainable way of living. So I do think we need to change the way that we live our lives and need to make these choices. Also, I'd encourage people to, I had a very interesting meeting with an economist who was a Nobel Prize winner, Professor Oliver Hart. And he's got a very interesting outlook on corporate responsibility. And he was arguing that sometimes it's better to buy shares in some of these dodgy companies who are polluting in order to use your power as a shareholder to change their direction. And he seemed to think that was far more effective than getting people to divest. But so that's another option that people can take up.
A multifaceted way to kind of approach that then for people that, you know, want to get involved with that. Mike has turned the topic, though, to a local issue. He said the £20 cut in universal credit is affecting 9,990 families in your constituency. Have you been contacted by families struggling since this measure has been introduced?
I have, and it's been really difficult to say, I'm sorry, there's nothing I can do. It's the government that are introducing this cut. And people saying, well, how am I going to survive? Because it's not just the cut. When you look at it in context of inflation rising, so things costing more, heating going up as well, things like fuel bills costing more, petrol going up as well. So everything's going to cost more. So it's not as if you're having a standing start. The cut comes on top of price increases and inflation, which means people will really struggle even more than they did before the £20 universal credits increase was introduced during the pandemic. So it will be even worse for people now with this £20 cut.
Well, this kind of couples up with, you know, you expressed your upset at the autumn budget, stating that you believe, you know, constituents will be hit, have you explained there. But you also stated that the government has showed where its loyalties are by cutting taxes on champagne and bankers. Obviously, the country is in a precarious financial position due to COVID. But how would Labour have managed the books differently? Would you have kept the £20 rise, or would you even have increased it to make the lives of, you know, the poorest in the country a bit easier?
Well, we definitely would have kept the increase because we know what a difference it makes to people's lives. Whether we'd be in a position to increase it would depend on the finances as we find with the next election. But certainly something we would have kept, and it would have made a big difference to people's lives. And as you prefaced in the question, it's a question of choices. We wouldn't have made some of the cuts that the some of the tax breaks that the government gave in the budget. So we would have prioritised other things. And one of the other things we would have prioritised was, rather than giving the bankers and cuts to champagne and other spirits and the cuts to internal flights, the tax cuts to internal flights, we probably would have kept those, and we would have use that to prioritise other things.
So let's continue with another viewpoint on a local issue. Sasha has said you've been involved in hearing and have opposed the plans by developer Viewpoint Estates to build 216 homes at Southgate Office Village. However, there is a housing shortage across the capital, she says. What could be done to make this project better for the area, in your opinion?
Well, I think a number of things. I mean, first of all, it's the type of accommodation that's being offered. So the accommodation they wanted to provide is a 1 and 2 bed accommodation. There's the scale of the accommodation. It's so vast it would dominate the skyline, and cast a shadow over M&S and Southgate. But in addition, I think the design is really poor. I think we should get back to, developers are going to build things that are going to be, they're going to try and get as much bang for their buck as possible. So clearly, this is an example of developers wanting to profit as much as they can, building the wrong sort of accommodation in the wrong part of town. So I wouldn't say no to any development there. I think the development that is there at the moment is much more low scale. So I think something that was significantly smaller and built on that site would be far more preferable. And if it was built, if the quality of what was built was decent as well, that would also be a big plus thing for me. But at the moment, what's been proposed is way too big, and not the sort of accommodation we want or need in that part of the borough.
Nigel has asked about Enfield Council's commitment to improving the environment. He says, how can the council say it is committed to this when they would not even consider pausing and reviewing the construction of a new, larger Edmonton incinerator?
Well, I can't speak for the council. Certainly, I think there are things the council have complete control over, which are things like planting more trees, and doing things encouraging people to be more to use their cars less, and those sorts of things. The incinerator is from North London Waste, so they've made a decision. They're a consortium of seven boroughs. Who are tasked with getting rid of our waste. And this is a decision that's taken some years ago. It's been approved by the Secretary of State a few years back. And yeah, I don't know how Enfield have justified their viewpoints, but I think the thinking is that the incinerator needs to is old and needs to be replaced with something that's more modern and will be less polluting. I think that's where their viewpoint would be. But I do think we need to look at other ways of reducing the amount of waste we produce. I'm a big fan of recycling. So if we produce less waste, there'd be less that goes to the incinerator. I think that would be a good way forward.
So, would you be yourself? Obviously, you're not part of the council. Would you oppose the construction of a new, larger incinerator, or would you even consider the pausing and re-reviewing the situation?
Well, I think trying to do things personally, I think incinerators are bad and we shouldn't have incinerators at all because I think they do pollute the environment. And but we're stuck with what we've got. We produce so much waste every year, and unless we can find a solution to get rid of the waste we produce, for me that is looking at more recycling and other alternatives. Then we can't use landfill. Maybe the solution is to send it abroad. I know some people do that, but personally, I'd be totally opposed to that as well. So it's the least worst option as things stand. But I am willing to listen and look at other alternatives. But at the moment, no one's come back to me with a solution that would get rid of all the waste we produce. That wouldn't involve either burying it or burning it.
Okay, and I guess if people do have strong opinions on that, how should they go forward with it? Should they contact you or should they contact the council?
Well, and the council obviously have two. They have two seats on the board, so there are seven authorities that will have two councillors. So they can obviously influence the councillors to take a view on things, but as I understand it, the decision was taken some time ago, so I'm not sure if they'll be able to revisit the decision. I mean, people are welcome to contact me if they want, but I don't have power over the decisions that are made at North London Waste, and so that would limit what I can and can't do.
Okay, so just to clear that up for people, because quite often people email in, and obviously you can give your opinion on certain aspects of local decisions, but you don't control everything, Bambos. You're not some sort of dictator of the area. Now, Ryan has said, I am very disappointed that the London Assembly has ignored the plights of London's many disabled people by rejecting our legitimate for ULEZ charges to be waived. Again, this is something that obviously you don't have control over, but is this maybe something that you believe should happen, and maybe you could put pressure on the London Assembly if you do believe that?
Well, I don't know what the effects are. I mean, clearly the ULEZ is for the cars that are polluting. So whether it's diesel or whether they're old cars that more than 15 or 16 years old that cause pollution. So I think the key, the purpose of the ULEZ is to reduce that air pollution. So I'm not sure what the exemption would be for, because I think the implication is that if you're a disabled person and has a car that pollutes, you should be exempt or you should pay less. Or if it's, I think that's the implication from the question. I mean, I'm happy to look at that, but I personally, I think that we do need to take a tough line on the on pollution. We discussed the incinerator just now. This is the Mayor of London being very proactive in trying to reduce pollutants in from cars. So, and that has to be a good thing. So, unfortunately, it may mean that people will have to get replacement cars if they drive through the ULEZ or pay the ULEZ charge. But I'm happy to look at the individual case. So if Brian wants to get in touch with me, if he's a constituent, then happy to follow that up.
Kind of looking at it, I'm approaching this from a neutral standpoint, of course, but Ryan or people with that viewpoint might believe that, you know, obviously you've said a little bit earlier that the cut, £20 a week cut to the universal credit could, you know, jeopardise a lot of people's problems. But, you know, for disabled people that may have to travel to hospital, to appointments, and they don't have much choice, again, on a limited budget, do you not think that that's kind of the same argument that you've made against the government could be used against yourself there?
Well, I mean, I think the... I mean, public transport is more accessible than ever before. So this would apply to private vehicles. And clearly, if people have a need to get out and about, then that's got to be, you know, that has to be taken into consideration. So I don't think it's the same argument, because I think this is, you know, the ULEZ charge, I get it that people may not have, you know, huge amounts of money. But if the vehicle that they have is compliant, they won't pay anything. So it's only about sort of pollution. It's a tough sort of measure. It's a tough thing to build in an exemption. But, you know, if you've got a car, you're probably in a slightly better position than some people who can't even afford a car. So it is, I know it's a problem, but I would say in those instances, public transport might be a better option.
Okay, we'll move it to the final question then, Bambos. And I hope that, you know, I usually try and end each of these interviews on a positive or try and get some sort of positive discussion. Tina has mentioned that it was World Mental Health Day. I think that was last month, if I'm correct. So this is her question. As someone who has a stressful job, and criticism from the public, how do you stay in charge of your mental health?
I mean, personally, I try and have some downtime, some time to myself where I do things that I enjoy doing, whether that's meeting up with friends or whether it's listening to music or, you know, watching a favourite film or something that is just me time. Also, I try not to take things personally, because I often deal with people who are very angry. Sometimes that anger is directed at the information that's at the situation that they're in, rather than taking it personally. So I try not to internalize that. But also a lot of the social media stuff, I get criticized on social media, but I just, you know, mute the conversation if I find that's like, if people are being rude and trying to wind me up. But you've got to take things with a pinch of salt. There are people who, you know, enjoy getting involved in cyber spats, and it really doesn't sort of, I think it's a waste of energy. You know, there are people who are so fixated in their views, they won't, you don't want to change their minds, they won't change your mind. So why go into that, you know, beg to differ and don't go down that path. So so it's just trying to see it for what it is, just trying to find time to de-stress and to make sure you're kind to yourself. That's what I tend to do.
Yes, and I think that hopefully is helpful advice for all the people, but hopefully people found all the discussions today informative and useful, Bambos. So just a huge, huge thanks for your time, and we will see you again next month for, I guess, an end-of-year roundup as well as some December questions as well. But thank you for your time, Bambos.
Pleasure, thank you.